I don't think I'm going to lecture for more than 18 hours. All right. Okay, folks. And these. I want to quickly go through two other passages in Kant's Perpetual Peace and then move on to Hobsbawm. But I thought it's actually instructive to take a look at the text close up, because the key to philosophy, as I've said before, is rereading, but also the point is to reread with the idea of reading closely. Philosophers are not noted always for their stylistic excellence. And so you often have to spend a considerable amount of time trying to penetrate what it is that they're saying. And that's certainly the case for Kant. There are only a couple of really great writers in the history of philosophy. Plato is one of them. Friedrich Nietzsche is another. And that's about it. Okay.
Saying they're all smart, they just can't put it down on paper.
Well, what they're putting down on paper is the depths of their thought without necessarily considering how to convey it to an audience, to a readership. So let's just take a quick look at a couple more passages from Perpetual Peace, and then we'll move on to Hobsbawm. Here we go. We were looking at the definitive articles last time, and the definitive articles, remember, are the articles that Kant believes, should they be adopted, would secure a lasting peace. And the general point that he's made to this, up until this section of the second definitive article, is that the two things. One is that it's necessary to do on the international level what has been done on the domestic level. And what I mean by that is that it's necessary to move internationally from a state of war and preparation for war between nations to a state of peace, just as we moved from a state of civil war, in essence, between individuals in society and a state of peace on the level of the domestic nation state. But Kant says, even though that's the case, even though it's necessary to repeat that movement, it's impossible to do it precisely. In other words, we cannot achieve the objective that we're trying to get at, namely perpetual peace, by doing what we did domestically, in other words, by creating a global government. Kant opposes this, but what he says is, in place of a global government, what we need is a League of Peace. A League of Peace, here, I'm looking right here. For these reasons, there must be a league of a particular kind. Well, actually, let's go up to this paragraph above. States do not plead their cause before a tribunal. War alone is their way of bringing suit. But by war and its favorable issue and victory, right is not decided. And though by a treaty of peace, this particular war is brought to an end, the state of war, of always finding a new pretext to hostilities, is not terminated. As long as the shape of the globe has been determined by the outcome of war, there is no justice. Kant doesn't say that the condition that currently exists is unjust. He simply says that justice doesn't pertain to relations between nations at all, until there is a state of international peace and therefore a state of law. Right now there is no tribunal for states to plead their cause before, and because there is no such tribunal, the only recourse that states have is to the application of violence. No one can condemn them for that. No one can condemn the outcome of war, lacking any alternative. And yet, it's important for us to recognize that the world, as it's been shaped by war, has not been shaped by principles of justice. It's simply, the existing boundaries between nation states are simply the outcome of the prevalence of force in the past. So this can't be declared wrong. Notwithstanding the obligation which men in a lawless condition have under the natural law, and which requires them to abandon the state of nature. This does not quite apply to states under the law of nations. Actually, I should read this on my, I'm sorry, I should read this on my screen rather than trying to read it. Actually, I'm going to, since my eyes are starting to, here we go, let me blow this up a bit. Yeah, here we go. Okay. What did I just do here? Okay, let me go back up. States do not please their cause before tribunal. War alone is their way of bringing suit. But by war and its favorable issue and victory, right is not decided. And though by a treaty of peace this particular war is brought to an end, the state of war, of always finding a new pretext to hostilities, is not terminated. Now, peace treaties can end particular conditions of war, particular wars between nations, but it doesn't end, but they do not end the state of war, the state of preparedness for war between nations. Nor can this be declared wrong, considering the fact that in this state, each is the judge in his own case. In the state of nature, there is no judge who stands over and above the parties to a dispute. The only judge that exists, or the only judges that exist, are the parties to the dispute. And lacking a common tribunal to settle disputes between individuals or individual states, there is only recourse to one's own judgment. Notwithstanding the obligation which men in a lawless condition have under the natural law, and which requires them to abandon the state of nature, does not quite apply to states under the law of nations, for as states, they already have an internal juridical constitution and have thus outgrown compulsion from others to submit to a more extended lawful constitution according to their ideas of rights, of right. So the United States, for example, has an internal juridical constitution. Juridical simply means legal or lawful. A constitution that is embodied in a set of laws. Constitutions do not necessarily have to be written. They can be tacit or understood. England has no written constitution, and yet it has a set of laws that structure British society, that structure British governmental institutions, and that structure British legal practices. And in that sense, it has a juridical constitution. What Kant is saying is that since individual states, you know, the United States, England, France, Sri Lanka, Nigeria, Chile, and so forth, have internal constitutions, they already exist as autonomous political entities. In other words, they are already the expression of the will and the consent of their own government. To submit them to a larger authority, to submit them to an international government, Kant is arguing, would in effect negate their expression, the fact that they express the will of their own people. And so you hear this argument quite often from forces that we generally consider to be conservative in the United States who oppose world government. Kant is simply agreeing with the conservatives on this. He is saying that world government would negate the freedoms that people have achieved on the level of individual nation states. And therefore, it's impossible to put an end to the international state of war by creating a world government.
Can you just repeat that one last thing you just
said? Okay. I know. This is complicated stuff. Here we are in the United States of America, and we have entered into a social contract with one another in the form of the Constitution. We have created a government, the purpose of which, at least in the language of the Constitution, is to protect liberties, to protect freedoms. We've created a governmental apparatus that's devoted to doing so. And to that extent, the constitution of the society, the makeup of the society in the broad sense, is an expression of our desire for freedom, Kant would say. To then subordinate the United States to a larger political entity, to incorporate it in as a kind of subunit into a global government, would be to negate, to deny, to break that expression of freedom that we've achieved on the domestic level. And so for Kant, there's no getting around the nation state. There's no getting past it. Kant is not suggesting that we break down nation states and replace them with a global government. Any kind of international arrangement that is capable of securing peace is going to have to recognize the sovereignty of nation states, Kant said. And remember now, Kant is writing at a time when the nation state, properly so called, is really just getting going. Now, the Republic, for him, is the most perfect expression of the nation state. And the reason why is that it's the Republic that recognizes that states derive their legitimacy from the consent of the governed. Well, a state that derives its legitimacy from the consent of the governed is not in a position to dissolve itself into a larger political entity. That's essentially what Kant is saying. So the idea of global government is off the agenda. What do we replace it with? If what gets us out of the state of war domestically into the state of domestic peace is the creation of a national government with a national set of laws, but if a global government is off the, you know, off the agenda, then how do we move internationally from a state of war to a state of peace? And so what Kant says is that what we need here is not a global government, but a league or a free federation of states. Let's read the passage. He says, this is, you know, it's true. The last sentence in that paragraph is that this is true. In other words, it's true that the sovereignty of nation states cannot be legitimately superseded, in spite of the fact that reason, from its throne of supreme moral legislating authority, absolutely condemns war as a legal recourse and makes a state of peace a direct duty. Even though peace cannot be established or secured except by a compact among nations, we have an obligation to work toward a state of international peace. We cannot get there by creating a global government, but we can get there, presumably, by creating some sort of compact among nations. So the question is now, what is the nature of that compact? And how does it differ from a global government?
What I don't understand is the constitution is made up by the government. That's what you said, right?
It's a theory, anyway. So,
But wouldn't all people want a certain set of freedoms that would be, as long as the government itself is not creating a constitution, all the people should want the same set of freedoms. So I don't see the problem with creating a global government, other than it would upset the nation state's government.
Now, that's an interesting point. In other words, why doesn't the same principle apply internationally that applies domestically? Right. If governments are instituted to protect liberties, then why should not a global government be instituted to protect liberties of everyone, all citizens?
Yeah. Well, it's a nice thought to be able to have a global government, but I mean, at the end of the day, I think that obviously different countries, different places, different cultures want different things, and you know, but I think that a global government would have just too much power, and you know, whose hands is that going to be held in, and then that's going to cause conflict, and you know, we don't all across the world they all think that the same things are important, which is why we go to war and things like that, and so. In the end, even though it seems that, you know, we all are looking for the same thing, maybe we're looking for it in different ways, or, you know, depending on who, you know, would hold that chair. You know, I mean, if it was, you know, the American government that became, you know, international, I mean, can you imagine what would happen with the recourse, you know, from other nations, you know, saying, you know, that we basically are telling them what to do, and we don't know their culture, their style, what they want, you know.
Yeah.
So
my wife pointed out that she saw on YouTube, no, actually it was a patient of hers that brought in on his cell phone a YouTube video, you know, an adolescent patient, and she's a psychologist, clinical psychologist, and he showed her this film of American, remember the show Jackass?
Yeah.
Well, these were American jackasses who went to India to challenge the yogis and tribal ascetics of India. You know, because the whole theme behind Jackass is you do these self-destructive things to yourself, right? And you do this before camera. Well, in India, there are long traditions of self-mutilation the challenging of the body, the submitting of the body to extreme conditions, which are part of the religious background of Indian society. So these African American young men, went to India to do their shenanigans among the Indians. And she said that the first thing that they did was, one of them, it was a bed of nails. And this is something that yogis traditionally do in the streets of India, a bed of nails. And so one of the guys lies down on the bed of nails. And of course, the nails are, you know, really sticking in there. And then the practice is the yogis put baskets of cobras, live cobras, on the chest of the person who is lying flat on the bed of nails. Well, one of the guys lies flat on the bed of nails, and they put the basket of cobras on him, and he completely freaks out. Completely freaks out. You know, get these cobras off of me. You know, help me up off of the bed of nails. Then they decide to go into the tribal area. You know, India has a lot of indigenous tribes.
Sure.
That are white, you know, the Americas, Native Americas. And so they go into a tribal area, and they're going to sort of repeat this to see whether they have better luck with the ascetics in the tribes. And one ascetic, takes out a knife and begins slicing into his own thigh. And the blood begins running down. And the jackasses turn and run in the opposite direction. Yeah, there's no way they're going to do that, right? They'll put on a helmet, you know, and go down, flip over on a bicycle or something like that, but there's no way they're going to take a knife and cut into their own thigh. And what she pointed out to me was that what it shows is the arrogance of these kids, right? These American kids who think that they can best the Indians at this. They have no idea what they're facing when they go to that culture. Absolutely no idea. It reminds me, I had a friend who was a Native American, actually taught here in the Graduate College of Education. She was a full-blooded Mohawk Indian. And she participates in Sundance. You know what Sundance is? It's a kind of pan-Indian religious ritual that developed in the 19th century. And one of the things, you dance in the sun, right? And you often dance staring at the sun. But the key part of Sundance is you are pierced. And so your skin is pierced and bone is inserted into the piercing, in the chest, or the back if you're a woman. And then that bone that's now embedded in your flesh is tethered to a central pole. And you dance around the pole until the flesh rips. And, you know, it's a conception of sacrifice, and it's also a way of inducing an altered state of consciousness. So she told me that there was this guy, his white buddy, who came to Sundance and insisted on piercing. You know, he would claim that he would be able to handle the pain. And so they inserted the thing, and he freaked out, obviously.
Did you say your wife does that?
My wife does not do that, no. Now, the person who told me about that was a Native American, actually taught here, but who participates in Sundance. And actually, it was interesting because I went to a religious ritual with her and a friend of hers, and I stayed with the friend at a hotel room, and the guy took off his shirt to go to bed at night, and you could see the scars from the piercing and from the pulling of the Sundance. Well, this just goes to show that our culture is not the standard of all cultures,
no.
Right? And your point is that a global government would be so distant from the realities of particular cultures that it would be experienced as an imposition. Yeah?
So wouldn't like freedom of religion, freedom of practice, freedom of all that allow that?
Yeah, what about that? What about that? Yeah.
I mean, we have that idea, but not everybody else has that idea. You know, I mean, just, I don't know. I'm not.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, Muslims. You know, at least as a whole, I don't want to have that, like, say, like, I'm prejudiced or like I know more than I do, because I don't. But I think that if they were, I mean, we ultimately, in this culture, we do have freedom of religion, but the overseers have religion, which is normally Christianity, Catholicism, and, you know, they could still look at that as a way of being taken over, and because they, no matter what, somebody's going to have some sort of religious opinion.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, go ahead, Nicole.
I just think that it would be impossible now to do a world government, and just the fact that if you have a small group of people who are in charge, just, it could be corrupt so fast, and then we would all be screwed because they're in charge of everybody, and then there's nothing that we can do.
So the world government should be UN to just have to reform and.
Now that's a different thing. You see, for Kant, although Kant did not live to see the United Nations, Kant would say that the United Nations is not a world government. It's something closer to his idea of a federation of independent states. Let's read on a little bit to see what he's getting at here. But all the points that you're making are important points and relevant ones. For these reasons, he says, there must be a league of a particular kind. A league among nations, which can be called a league of peace, and which would be distinguished from a treaty of peace by the fact that the latter terminates only one war, while the former seeks to make an end of all wars forever. This league of peace, or what he also calls a league of nations, this league does not tend to any dominion over the power of the state. In other words, dominion means rule, right? This league does not tend to any dominion over the power of the state, the nation state, the United States or whatever, but only to the maintenance and security of the freedom of the state itself and of other states in league with it, without there being any need for them to submit to civil laws and their compulsion, as men in a state of nature must. So the notion here is that a League of Peace or a League of Nations does not make laws which then must be obeyed and observed by the member states. It doesn't legislate tax policy for the United States. It doesn't legislate traffic laws for Sri Lanka. All of the liberties of the nation state, all of the political freedoms of the nation state remain intact, according to Kant, given the development of a league of the kind that he has in mind. So what good is it? You know, what does it accomplish if it leaves national sovereignty intact? Let's continue, okay? The practicability of this idea of federation, which should gradually spread to all states, and thus lead to perpetual peace, can be proved. For if fortune directs that a powerful and enlightened people can make itself a republic, which by its nature must be inclined to perpetual peace. Remember, Kant argues that republics, because they govern with the consent of the governed, tend to be peaceable, right? If that can happen, this gives a fulcrum to the federation with other states, so they may adhere to it and thus secure freedom under the idea of the law of nations. Okay, so what is Kant saying here? Oh, but let's take a look at the last sentence. By more and more such associations, the federation may gradually be extended. All right, there are a couple of points here. One is that Kant is envisioning a federation of republics, each of which is itself already inclined toward peace, given the fact that each republic is an expression of the consent of the governed. He also has the notion that there that a League of Peace would begin with a, how can I put it, with a subset of all nation states.
What?
In other words, with a, I said a subset. In other words, at the beginning, not every nation state would belong to the League of Peace. And I take it that he indicates that by saying, by more and more such associations, the Federation may gradually be extended. So what he has in mind is the coming together, initially, of a group of republics dedicated to preserving peace among them, and then the gradual extension of that federation to include more and more states. Okay, let's continue and see what he has to say. We may readily conceive that a people should say, there ought to be no war among us, for we want to make ourselves into a state, that is, we want to establish a supreme legislative, executive, and judiciary power which will reconcile our differences peaceably. But when this state says, there ought to be no war between myself and other states, even though I acknowledge no supreme legislative power by which our rights are mutually guaranteed, it is not at all clear on what I can base my confidence in my own rights, unless it is the free federation, the surrogate, of course here means substitute, the surrogate of the civil social order, which reason necessarily associates with the concept of the law of nations, assuming that something is really meant by the latter. Let me continue on here to the next paragraph. The concept of a law of nations as a right to make war does not really mean anything, because it is then a law of deciding what is right by unilateral maxims through force, and not by universally valid public laws which restrict the freedom of each one. In other words, a law of nations that in which the right to make war is retained by nation states is not a state of justice. It's not a state of genuine law, Kant would say. The only conceivable meaning of such a law of nations might be that it serves men right who are so inclined that they should destroy each other and thus find perpetual peace in the vast grave that swallows both the atrocities and their perpetrators. In other words, a law of nations understood as the preservation of the right of individual nation states to go to war ultimately leads to the perpetual peace of the mass grave, Kant is saying here. For states and their relation to each other, there cannot be any reasonable way out of the lawless condition which entails only war, except that they, like individual men, should give up their savage, lawless freedom, adjust themselves to the constraints of public law, and thus establish a continuously growing state consisting of various nations which will ultimately include all the nations of the world. But under the idea of a law of nations, they do not wish this and reject in practice what is correct in theory. If all is not to be lost, there can be then, in place of the positive idea of a world republic, only the negative surrogate of an alliance which averts war, endures, spreads, and holds back the stream of those hostile passions which fear the law, though such an alliance is in constant peril of breaking loose again. Okay, it's a tongue twister, and he said a lot of stuff here. But does anyone want to take a stab at interpreting? Yeah.
All right. It's like five nations start out together, like the UN.
Yeah.
And you still have all the other nations that are involved. So it's basically one against five. And then one more joins. So now it's one against six. And then one more joins. Now it's one against seven. But until it's all the seven that are uniting against war, still have to impose war against those who won't join them.
Or they have to be ready to defend themselves at the very least.
So until everyone's together, war is still a possibility, in a sense, and their unity is is void, because war, the goal they're going for is no war, but they're never going to get there without showing that they can still do war.
Right. Yes, go ahead.
Could they do, like, each continent has its own government like that instead? Because I don't, having one and then add another and another, wouldn't that then take forever?
Well, but Kant envisions something like this, because remember, he says in a couple of paragraphs above, by more and more such associations. So I imagine that what he has in mind is something like what is happening in Europe right now, where European nations are federated into the European Union. Now, the European Union, at least formally, doesn't interfere with the sovereignty of individual European states, but there's still a common framework that works out certain issues that connect those nations with one another, like the common currency, right? Mm-hmm. Like eventually a common defense policy. At least that's what the framers of the European Union have in mind. So let's assume that that process continues, and that the European Union creates a situation in which there are peaceful relations among European states, which is by no means a short short order, or an easy order. Because think about it, there were two world wars that involved European states in the 20th century, which led to 110 million dead. So, but let's say that the European Union has a future to it, and that it actually does guarantee peaceful relations among European states. And we now see something similar happening in Latin America. The Brazilian government, under Lula, has created something called Mercosur. Now, Mercosur is just the beginnings of a trade agreement between Latin American countries independently of the United States. Now, Latin America has often seen itself as a colonial backyard to the U.S. And, in fact, it has been a colonial backyard for a long period of time. But now what we're beginning to see is the start of independent connections between Latin American states. Let's say that that continued, and eventually Latin American states begin to pacify their relations with one another in a federation of states. Okay. And perhaps something similar in Asia, you know, China, Korea, Japan, and so forth. Yeah.
Well, did what you think that as far as European Union, where they join forces together, which is the countries that don't want to join forces together, so they are making travel, so the rules and regulations as far as credential money and travel,
right,
and stuff like that. Because when Europeans rule out a certain passport or a certain travel document, so they will only recognize their own, but as far as country that is not part of the EU is not recognized where...
Right. So well, then you're simply a foreign visitor if you're from outside of the...
Yeah, as far as trading and stuff like that. Right. When you join forces, you get money, economic structure, stuff like that. So if you... Or it's maybe certain rules and regulations that you're not following. If you're not following, you're not part of the...
Right.
So it's... But it's...
It is amazing when you think about it, because I remember when I was traveling in Europe as in my 20s, every nation you crossed, you had to present the passport, and the particular nation would stamp put its own stamp on your passport. So if you're going from Germany to France, or from France to Italy, or from Italy to Spain, you would cross the border, you'd have to present your card to the border guard, and they would put the stamp of the national state that you were crossing into. Well, now the whole of Europe is unified. All Europeans have a single passport, and of course they don't need a passport in order to travel internally anymore. They can cross into any member nation state that they want without presenting a passport. When Americans go, you present a passport when you enter and then when you leave, yeah.
So, let's say you have the European Union and one of the countries decides to attack another one, what would the rest of them do?
Well, that's a good point. And I think that you're raising the critical issue, I think, when it comes to the practicality of Kant's proposal. But Kant recognizes that this is a long process, right? See, the problem is this, that at any given moment, the federation of states devoted to peace is, until every nation is a part of it, is going to exclude certain nations. And there the problem that you raised comes in. You know, what do you do when there is hostility coming from outside of the league? Or a member nation, there'll be a, you know, political movement to break away. So what happens when a member nation breaks away and then there's hostility between the league and that previous member state? See, it seems to me that what Kant is suggesting here is that such an alliance is in constant peril of breaking loose again. It seems to me that what he's suggesting here is that perpetual peace is not guaranteed by the structure of an international federation of states devoted to peace. That it's a process that's constantly got to be negotiated and renegotiated, you know, and renewed. And it seems to me also he's not excluding the possibility of war breaking out. You know, should the alliance break up and should states that break away become hostile again. But I think what he does have in mind is that this process of creating a federation and then engaging in the politics necessary to preserve it or to put it back together again if it should fall apart tends in the direction internationally of an alleviation of hostilities. In other words, what you've got here, if I wanted to give the most charitable interpretation to Kant's scheme that I could, what I would say is that what you have here is a process of continuing, imperfect, gradual, and constantly needing to be renewed pacification, to put it that way.
In order to be recognized?
To keep the peace.
Yeah,
in order to keep the peace. So that's just like when, for example, how President Obama just went to Russia and had negotiations about the nuclear war. Is that?
Yeah, exactly. In other words, that an international alliance with laws and tribunals and so forth, that doesn't put an end to the problems.
Yeah, it's still gonna be.
It just creates a structure for dealing with the problems and continuing to, you know, to express the will to settle differences without violence. I don't think that there's any institutional structure. And I think Kant is recognizing this. That there's any institutional structure that can guarantee the end of war. But unless people are willing and mobilized to constantly work at it. Because after all, tensions are going to crop up under any conceivable political setup. But once you have an expressed will to put an end to war, and once you have a federation in place, then at least there's the institutional context for making the compromises and making the agreements and so forth. It's not quite a utopian vision, in other words. You know, Kant's view of perpetual peace seems utopian when you first look at it. But when you look at the details, he's actually pretty pragmatic. You know, the federation is going to have a renewed danger of breaking up. You know, there's that constant possibility. What you need is continual application. Now, in the case of, remember Kant says that he's not envisioning here a global government. He's not even envisioning an international federation with a military capability. Because remember, one of the things that he says is, and certainly not a military capability that would be deployed against, for example, human rights violations. Because what he says is that no state has the right to interfere with the domestic affairs of another state. We're going to see that when we read Habermas. Habermas thinks that this is one of the primary weaknesses of Kant's scheme for perpetual peace, namely that it makes no provision for an international military capability, and that it makes no provision for intervention in the case of massive human rights violations, in cases of genocide and so forth. And Habermas is going to make his own proposals for revising the Kantian structure in that way. What we've seen is two attempts to create the League of Nations that Kant talks about in Article 2. You know, one was the League of Nations after the Second World War, a very imperfect alliance, in part because it grew out of the end of the First World War and was tied to things like the Versailles Treaty, which, you know, imposed draconian conditions on Germany and created the seeds of the Second World War. That fell apart. The United States didn't even join. Wilson, who was president at the time, wanted the U.S. in the League of Nations, but U.S. entry into the League was blocked by the U.S. Senate, and felt that it was a dangerous dilution of principles of sovereignty. So the League of Nations was sort of a non-starter. But then remember what happened was the Second World War. And 10 million dead in the First World War, 100 million dead in the Second World War. So in, I forget whether it was 45 or if I think it was 46, Kant's project is revived again, and this time in the form of the United Nations. The United Nations has all kinds of problems, right? I mean, obviously, the UN has not put an end to war. There have been any number of wars since the end of the Second World War, including wars that the U.S. has been involved with, you know, Korea, Vietnam, the First Gulf War, the Second Gulf War, and so on and so forth. And then there have been plenty of wars in Africa, and between African nations and Latin America and so forth, and Asia. And so it hasn't done what Kant wanted a federation of states to do. Now, one question that we can ask, and we'll ask it when we take a little bit closer look at Habermas, is the failure of the UN to move in the direction of an international peace a result of the fact that Kant was just wrong? In other words, that there really is no solution internationally, that the perpetual peace of the mass grave is the only thing that we have to look forward to? Or is it because the institutions of the UN don't live up to Kant's model? Or is it because that Kant's model is flawed and yet there is still a solution to the problem of international war? Okay, so I mean, these are tough questions, and they're the questions that we're going to face. I'm convinced they're going to be the major questions, or among the major questions that we're going to face in the 21st century. Read Habermas's Barbarism: A User's Guide, and next time we will talk about what happened in the wake of Kant's death, in particular what happened during the 20th century, and what the real background is to the problems of international peace that we face now. Okay, folks? So do that, and oh, we're a little bit early. Just sit down and put your heads on the desk for 4 minutes. See you next time.
Oh, this is one.
Ah. Excuse me. Okay. Did you get your paper? I forget.
Yeah,
I did get it.
Right.
You got that?
Yes, yes.
Okay, great. Okay.
He can't get it.
Okay. Thank you.
The teacher always talks to
me. I'm glad you stopped and slowed me down. I think I was off in the stratosphere.
I was trying to write the sentence.
I know. So it's difficult.
It is.
It really is hard.
It's burning and stuff.
Yeah.
It doesn't like just like flow. You know?
It doesn't flow. And Kant is, you know, he's a philosopher. He's also a philosopher of law in this case. So
oh, he's so that's like more the language.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Juridical.
I actually want to ask you, so you said you were teaching Tuesday and Thursday next semester, and then you
had an
online class. So do they like accept, like, if I were to take like the online class, would they accept that like as a regular
course? Oh yeah, that's just a regular course.
Oh really?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
That's a regular course. But be careful though, because are you on financial aid?
Yeah.
make sure that you're financially able to pay for it.
Okay.
Yeah. That's been one issue with some students in the past.
Okay.
I think it depends upon the nature of your aid, whether or not it will pay for the continuing ed class. But the continuing ed class counts just like any other class.
Yeah,
yeah.
I think so.
Yeah.
And
that'd be good for you, actually, too.
Yeah, because
and also because, you know, if you're going to be laid up at some point, you know,
yeah,
it'd be easier to do stuff from home.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
If not, though, what are you teaching on Tuesdays?
On Tuesdays and Thursdays, I'm doing this class again, and I'm also doing Intro to Philosophy.
Okay.
But when? I'll have to check my schedule.
Okay. Yeah, email me. Let me know, because I really would like to take a class
with
you again.
That's nice of you. I appreciate it.
That's
How are you feeling, by the way?
I'm feeling okay. I